Are we live now?
I'm recording.
You're listening to Mumbrella Cast.
Mumbrella Cast.
Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast. The astute amongst you may have noticed that I'm not Tim Burrows. It is, in fact, editor Vivian Kelly here. Depending on when you're listening to this, Tim may be flying back from Singapore. He may be back in Sydney in the throes of Mumbrella 360 planning. Or who knows, maybe it's the future and the robots have taken over and this is your last form of human contact. Oh, the wonders of podcasting. But Burrows fans, don't panic, because thanks to the magic of podcasting, you'll be hearing from Tim later as he chats over the phone with comedy legend Sean McAuliffe about why Australian TV networks are struggling to keep up with Netflix.
Makes it very, very difficult to try and make anything in Australia that can stack up.
Coming to terms with his new role.
Quite frankly, I don't know what I'm doing or what it is or what the value of it is.
Plus, that infamous 10 breakfast interview.
No one looked up from their notes and I thought, oh man, I just completely misread this room entirely.
But joining me this week to break down the media and marketing industry is Mumbrella's features and opinion editor Josie Tutty, who is pushing the buttons.
Hello.
And our senior media reporter who has been practicing her vocal exercises courtesy of a trip to The Voice, Zoe Samios.
Hello.
So this week we will be discussing the third radio ratings of the year are in.
Ogilvy rebrands.
Bauer Media is finally back on the acquisition trail.
Media buyers speak out on Nielsen metrics.
So Zoe, it's one of our favourite times of the year, which luckily occurs 8 times a year. Radio Ratings Day was on Tuesday. Look, a lot happened and you spend so much time speaking to all the radio content bosses and breaking down what's happening. But as Sydney-centric as we are sometimes accused of being, I do think the big story here is Today FM, which is Southern Cross Oz Stereo's station, which now has a 5.6% share of total people. That doesn't sound very high, and in all honesty, it's not very high, but it's their highest since Kyle and Jackie O defected to KISS at the end of 2013. Do you think Today FM has finally turned things around?
I do. I think, you know, they've had a very strong start to this year in that they've had growth every single ratings survey. That did not happen last year. So I think things have sort of turned around in that respect. Obviously, this survey did include weeks, and I don't have the exact dates on me, but it did include the weeks where there was quite a bit of controversy around the Today FM breakfast host, Em Rusciano. For those of you who weren't on our podcast a couple of weeks ago, we did talk about that. Basically, there were things said on a podcast with another station's breakfast host, and that would be Southern Cross Stereo's Triple M breakfast host, Will Anderson in Melbourne. He runs a podcast called Willosophy, and there was some stuff said about Em, her time on the show, her new hosts and her old hosts. And to put it simply, she was quite upset, visibly upset. But what that hasn't really seemed to impact these particular ratings. It seems if anything, people have sort of wanted to listen more. It's almost like controversy has gone, oh, everyone kind of wants to see what she's going to say next.
Well, for somebody who, look, doesn't get fantastic ratings, she certainly does generate a lot of media coverage. So perhaps people were tuning in to listen to see what the dynamic was, because I know so much of the speculation was Ed Cavalli is not talking to Em Rusciano as a result. Grant Denyer, who also hosts Family Feud on 10 and soon to be Game of Games on 10, sort of also spoke to the media and said, oh, I'm not going to comment on that, which almost fuels the fire even more. So I'm sure people were tuning in. Look, they went up 0.5 share points, which isn't a lot. They're on 4.9% now, that particular breakfast show. But they started the year on 3.4%. And with her old co-host, Harley Breen, they hit a low point of 2.8%. So 4.9% comparatively would probably be quite good for SCA.
It definitely is. And it definitely puts them back in the game. The closest people to them are probably, or the closest in sort of hosts and the likes, is probably Nova, which has Fitzy and Whipper, and KISS, which has Kyle and Jackie O. Obviously very well-known people, very strong brands in themselves. But what was interesting was actually, and I like to do this sort of every survey, is talk to these content bosses. So we obviously have the chance to look at not only the ratings but talk about these wider issues. This survey I got to speak to from ARN, which runs KIIS and WSFM, Gold FM in Melbourne, Duncan Campbell, Hit Network's head of content, Gemma Fordham, Triple M's head of content, Mike Fitzpatrick, Paul Jackson, who's the group program director at Nova. What I wanted to talk to them about this week was this controversy and this idea of controversy and how it sort of impacts ratings.
Duncan had a few things to say.
Duncan did have a few things to say. His main point was that contractually he didn't believe and Rusciano was allowed to say some of the things she said. He said he would have gone as far as to fire her. That obviously did not sit well with Gemma Fordham, who is the big boss of Em Rusciano, who said that she wasn't going to enter into a schoolyard bullying match with Duncan, which is totally fair. This happens quite often on survey day. Everyone's sort of throwing things at one another. But what it did tell me was that everyone has their own way of dealing with this stuff. Mike Fitzpatrick dealt with Will Anderson completely differently. They actually addressed it on air. They were all very open about it. So it really just comes down to the people. And I also speak to Macquarie Media's Adam Lang. He's the CEO there. He obviously, their stations include 2GB, 3AW. So they obviously have shock jocks always causing controversy. And again, he has a very different way of handling it. And I think that was really interesting to see.
There's a certain amount of irony here in ARN's Duncan Campbell talking about controversial talent when he is effectively in charge of Kyle Sanderlands. So it's almost a matter of maybe controversy's good and courting this kind of controversy. I don't know if Em Rusciano is courting controversy. I obviously believe that Kyle Sanderlands does. But I don't think there's any need to talk about firing people when so many radio hosts are shock jocks and do rely on getting that attention and drawing people in by having that intrigue of, ooh, do they hate each other? Do they like each other? What will they do next?
And it definitely doesn't hurt the ratings, as we have discovered from this book.
Definitely. And to give listeners some context, as I said, Em, Grant and Ed finished up on 4.9% this survey. Rove and Sam, who are previous Today FM breakfast hosts, went out on 3.8%. Jules Lund's program with Sophie Monk, Mel B and Merrick Watts finished with 3%, and Dan and Maz always hovered around the 3% mark as well. So 4.9 is low, but it's better than anything they've done in the past 5 years. So also in news this week, we had Ogilvy releasing its global rebrand, which has been a long time in the making. Really notable with this one is the fact that they have ditched founder David Ogilvy's signature as their logo, which they adopted in about 1999. So they're describing this as a refounding. It certainly feels like they're trying to start again. There's all sorts of buzzwords in announcements like this, and they've talked about how they've reorganized under six units, which is advertising, customer engagement and commerce, earned influence and public relations, digital transformation and partnerships. It's certainly a bigger trend in holding companies to do this kind of thing and talk about restructures and realignments, but this one is particularly big for WPP in that they are seemingly moving away from that iconic imagery of David Ogilvy's signature and trying to position themselves a little bit differently. And
this is a definite rebrand. It's not the kind of, oh, we've slightly tweaked the font. They've gotten rid. Well, this is something that's kind of been, they've been phasing out the signature as logo for quite a while now, but this is the first time they've officially said, look, this is what we're doing. But I think what's interesting from a local perspective is Ogilvy have already started trying to do these kind of restructures and rearrangements. Back in March in Sydney, they reshuffled their creative arm to merge creative, social and content creatives into one team. But when that happened, the question I had is, shouldn't you really be doing that anyway? And part of me does feel slightly like this reshuffling is probably something that smaller, more agile agencies have already been doing, and perhaps because they're such a giant brand, it's just taken them a long time to catch up.
And locally as well, we then had Ogilvy PR renamed to simply OPR with Kieran Moore, who is the CEO WPP AUNZ PR and PA, which quite frankly has to be a contender for the most acronyms in one job title, saying same leadership, same talent, same expertise, and a different name. Why do you think they're wanting to move away from Ogilvy? It's such an iconic name. I knew the name even before I was of this industry, of this world. OPR to me means nothing.
It's a tricky one. And part of me does wonder who made that decision. Is this coming from the top? Would you really want to get rid of that Ogilvy brand that has such strength?
And Zoe, I know you're our media reporter, but you did used to report on the creative space when you were but a young junior journo. What do you think? Do you think there are just too many agencies, too many brands and too many sub-brands? There's so many, and we get a release almost every day about a rebrand or a reshuffle or a restructure or a holding company moving this to this or that to that. Do we have too many?
Definitely. I think we massively overcomplicate it. When I was working in creative agencies, obviously you've got holding groups, then you have a next level down. Within that, you'll have sub agencies that might do design or video or something. One of the things I really didn't like about that at the time was I felt like, especially in creative agencies, creative is a very broad term. You don't really need to dissect that into video design. Isn't that all under the one umbrella? And does that confuse people? You could argue that maybe, yes, they've got, you know, specialties in that, but I don't, all it does to me is it's not top of mind. A brand like Ogilvy would be top of mind to me because it's a big, powerful powerhouse. Anything within that I wouldn't be so familiar with.
I'm trying to think of an appropriate line to wrap this up that isn't time will tell, but I certainly think that this isn't the end of shakeups at a holding company level, whether it's locally, globally or both. So watch this space. And we had a bit of different news this week from Bauer Media, who in recent years have been known for closing titles, restructuring, letting people go, changing their digital strategy, integrating things, separating things, bringing them back together. It's certainly been an overall narrative of decline, whether they wanted to admit that or not. That's certainly what the industry was taking from it. But this week, Bauer Media have gone back on the acquisition trail, acquiring Inside Out, Country Style and Home Life from News Corp. A Bauer spokesperson did tell me that there would be no redundancies as a result of the acquisition, which was quite frankly a phrase I haven't heard from them for a while. Zoe, why are they buying things when before they've been trying to reduce the number of people, titles and resources?
I had a lot of time to think about that this week, and I think the thing to remember with Bauer at the moment is it's been almost a year since Paul Dykesall came in. He was the CEO of Bauer Media in New Zealand. He's now come into Australia. A lot of what he was doing at the start, definitely, and probably Nick Chan, who was the former CEO, was doing too, was tightening the business. So I think what we've seen in the last couple of years is, okay, what's not working? Let's consolidate that. One of the more interesting things he did earlier, I think it was earlier this year actually, was actually bring digital back into the print side of the business, which to most people would sound like quite obvious, but they were actually quite separate. So he's done a lot of things like that. But then he actually appointed Fiorella De Santo, who was actually their director of sales, to a GM of publishing role. And I'm not going to say which parts of the she does because I'm going to get it wrong, but I think it's something like luxury, food.
It's got a lot of words.
Fashion. It's a lot of different areas. But what I think is really interesting about this acquisition is that she is trying to fill gaps in an offering from both a consumer and commercial perspective. So she's looking at everyone from a very cheap renter to someone that might like aesthetics or interior design to, you know, luxury. And what she's done by getting these three titles in is being able to fill that out. So if you're a brand that's interested, you've now got access to a full stable. Why she hasn't done that in other sectors, I'm guessing she's seen massive opportunity from a revenue perspective or a commercial perspective in home. That might be the case in other sectors, but this is obviously the first move. What it looks like they're doing is working out their strengths and trying to solidify that.
But did they not last year ditch Yours, Recipes Plus and Home Plus?
They did, which I did ask Fiorella about because obviously Homes Plus does fall within that category. Her argument, if I remember correctly, was that while it was a sort of the budget end of the market, it wasn't quite strong enough from a commercial perspective. So I think it's Inside Out, or it might be Home Life actually. One of the two definitely fits in a lot better with that. I think they've got Real Living as well. So there's obviously other areas where that kind of consumer was going to be in other titles. So that was sort of the logic behind that. But yeah, definitely raised a lot of questions when they were axing a title that did sit within that sort of category.
And my question is, from News Corp's perspective, why did they want to get rid of these brands? And part of me wonders, considering Bauer is a direct rival of theirs, were these the publications that they felt like they wanted to get rid of because perhaps they were not performing as well as the others?
I think it's definitely the latter. I think, you know, News Corp's got some really strong magazine brands, especially in food. They've got Delicious, Taste. They also have Luxury, so GQ and Vogue. They're very, very strong in that space. From my perspective, if there were magazines to go, it was probably these ones, and it could definitely fill out the offering that Bauer definitely desired. But it seems like everyone's looking to play in a certain space now and have different offerings. And Fiorella comes from News Corp. She's actually got more than 20 years experience in that building. She knows what those brands are like. She probably saw it well before she joined Bauer, so it was only a matter of time.
It's a bit like holding companies in that, are there just too many of these magazines? Magazine readership is declining. There's just no question about it. If we're talking about physical print magazines, it's declining. There's so many brands now in this space. I know that Bauer are saying, we're still going to print it, we're not going to cut anything, but there's less people accessing this and so many titles. Zoe, you already mentioned Real Living. Bauer mentioned in their release a number of other titles that they already have in this space, including Belle, I think, and a number of others. And I just thought that is a lot when there's not as many people paying for this printed product anymore and engaging with it.
It feels like they really do need to focus on that digital offering, build up the social media. And these type of publications are ones that could potentially do well on social media. They've got the Pinterest boards going on. You know, that the audience is there, but I think the audience is online. And if they don't kind of realize that and build that very strongly along with that print offering, I think they might have a few issues.
There's one more thing I'd probably add to that, and that's totally right. But I think the appeal of that was the brand itself. And I think what I've noticed in covering the publishing space is the brands or the print mags that will succeed potentially are the ones that have a very strong brand identity. And that's not talking about print or digital. That's talking about, what does Women's Weekly mean to me? What does Women's Day mean to me? What does New Idea mean to me? It's deciding how much of a strong presence they have, and they can change mediums. We can always change mediums, but if there's not a strong brand identity, it's kind of redundant. And in Inside Out, Country Style, I can remember reading in almost every place that I've been to. When you've got a brand like that, maybe the print does scale back eventually, but if you've got something that is so powerful, you can easily adapt it to different mediums and follow the audience.
Country Style is definitely a magazine that's been in almost every holiday rental house. Ooh, yeah. I've been in up and down the Australian East Coast, so I think you're onto something there. Look, speaking of publishing, Zoe, you've been knee-deep, probably neck-deep in Nielsen metrics and Nielsen dramas this week. I think you know more about Nielsen than anyone I know. Sometimes I think you know more about Nielsen than Nielsen does. So I'm not even going to bother to intro this. I'm just going to let you speak. What have you been doing with Nielsen this week?
Okay, well, I think before I go into what I've been doing this week, for those of you who don't know what Nielsen does and who they are, Nielsen is a measurement company for publishers specifically. It measures audience. It also looks at things like changing behaviors with consumers. It looks at total audience. It looks at time spent. It looks at a variety of different factors that provide insight to brands and agencies about a particular publishing brand. Nielsen's also the industry measurement standard. So it is the recognized and IAB certified, so Interactive Advertising Bureau certified measurement solution. And what they've had in market for a number of years, a form or a measurement solution called Digital Ratings Monthly. What Digital Ratings Monthly provided was a top line view of total audience. When Mumbrella got it, we also looked at time spent on site, sessions per person. What they recently introduced last year was a metric called digital content ratings. What digital content ratings does is it's able to measure off-platform measurements, so things like Facebook, Google, accelerated mobile pages, number of things like that. So DCR also offers a more granular sort of audience view. They've been distributing that weekly to us at Mumbrella through a newsletter. they're now about to introduce a monthly sort of overlaying metric that they can distribute widely. But basically the DCR metric is a build off the DRM metric. So what's been happening in the publishing space over the last few months is that a number of major and small to medium publishers have had issues with both the DRM methodology and the DCR methodology. The DCR methodology not being quite there yet, the DRM methodology being outdated. There's been a number of issues. Probably most notable was when Fairfax Media decided to withdraw from the DCR metric. So DCR uses a thing called SDK tagging, and I'm going to forget what the acronym, what that specifically stands for, but basically what that means.
We can forgive you. Yes, it's an acronym-heavy episode.
Yeah, acronym-heavy episode.
In the past few minutes, you've almost said more than Kieran Moore's job title. So
exactly. So SDK, what that does is a publisher will attach a tag to their website, their other platforms, and they're basically that Nielsen's able to track that. That's basically how it works. That's a very simplified version of how it works.
What if I'm not happy with Nielsen? Do I even have an alternative? If I'm a publisher, I think that the content rating isn't up to scratch, the monthly one's out of date, what can I do?
Well, it's really difficult because Comscore, which was an alternative, has left the market. There are a number of redundancies last year and they've left. The other issue is that IAB is, you know, the industry body, and IAB has certified Nielsen. Now, I believe Nielsen's contract might be up next year or the year after. But as far as I understand it, the IAB and Nielsen have quite a robust relationship. So it's really difficult. In Fairfax's case, they're using their own third-party data. The problem that's arisen, and this is what I learned this week with when talking to media buyers about this, is that if you do pull out, if you do cancel your contract with Nielsen, agencies are very wary. Ultimately, Nielsen is incredibly important as a metric. It's one that they compare to a number of different data sets. But even despite how angry or how frustrated publishers may be, ultimately, it is very, very difficult for them. They're in a very, very, they kind of have their hands tied.
So media buyers and planners obviously are the ones that place ads for brands and tell people where to place those ads and book those ads. So you spoke to a number of media agencies about Nielsen this week. What do they think? My understanding is they think it's flawed but necessary. Is that right?
Yeah. The argument for the most part is there's gaps in the methodology, particularly the DCR methodology. It's just not quite there yet, which is to be expected given how quickly we've advanced and how quickly digital publishers have advanced and where their audiences are. But they've said that it's necessary. Ultimately, it is the industry standard. Whether or not they actually agree with it is a separate thing. But the fact of the matter is, while all the publishers are in there and while IAB is certifying that measurement solution, it is what it is. And, you know, they have to compare that and use a number of sets. They have emphasized that they are using a number of different sets. And I think in one instance, if one of the heads of digital, Amelia Elston from Amplify, was saying that, you know, if it did get to the point where the numbers were so, there was such a large disparity in numbers between that and other data sets, they would look at a bigger figure and they would reassess. But ultimately, Nielsen is one of the most recognized industry standards, industry metrics, and it makes it very difficult for publishers that don't feel that their audiences are being reflected by Nielsen.
So what about smaller publishers? Because someone like Fairfax has a lot of weight and money to throw around, and they can perhaps put some political pressure on the likes of the IAB and Nielsen in turn. What if I'm a small publisher who's not happy with what I'm getting? Am I just going to have to suck it up?
Oh, gosh, you're going to have to suck it up. Look, at the moment, they're all in discussions. I'm well aware that they're in discussions and trying to resolve the issues they have. Ultimately, they don't want to pull, but ultimately they're also paying a sizable amount of money, even though it's significantly less than the likes of, you know, a News or a Fairfax or a Seven or a Nine. It's still a lot of money to them. And if their audiences aren't being reflected, well, what are they paying for, essentially?
And with the small publishers, am I right in thinking that the panel-based data doesn't reflect them accurately at all? Because if the people on that panel don't happen to read those websites, then they basically show up as nothing.
Yeah, exactly. So the DRM methodology is a combination of panel-based data with the tagging that is solely in DCR. The argument is that if you're a small publisher, the tagging doesn't really work in that instance. And when you're on a panel, if you're a niche publisher, if you're a, oh God, I don't know, if you're targeting, say, the over 60s or, you know, between if you're like a punky or a Pez, if you're targeting specific niche bits, you're hoping that the panel is going to be, you know, has some young people in there. If they don't, they're probably not going to know it. So for the people that are actually in niche segments, it actually becomes really challenging. And in the last 2 months, Nielsen won't actually give us those numbers. So we've been able to have access to the smaller publishers' DRM numbers. They're not now giving that. Now they're saying that they need to work out how to accurately measure audiences. My understanding is that the publishers are so frustrated that their audiences are not being communicated that Nielsen's actually had to pull back.
Well, now we're through the wonders of technology and podcasting, going to throw to Tim on the phone with Sean McAuliffe. But thank you, Zoe, and thank you, Josie, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Joining us now on the Mumbrella Cast is one of TV's funniest presenters, Sean McAuliffe, currently hosting Talking About Your Generation, newly rebooted on Nine. Now, Sean, Talking About Your Generation was a huge hit when it came on air in 2009. What do you think was it about it that worked so well?
I must admit, on the eve of its broadcast, I was thinking, well, this will either be acceptable or it could easily pass unnoticed. You know, I really didn't. Well, we had fun making it, but I guess my job was really just to jolly it along. The idea for it existed before I was involved. And I think the reason that I did it was because my children at that point were quite young and hadn't seen me in anything. And the opportunity for them to actually see me on TV at a time when they were awake. I was on SBS at 10 o'clock or something doing a news satire sort of thing, which, of course, they just wouldn't be interested in no matter what time it was on, let alone 10 o'clock. So it was a calculated attempt to win over my children. And I guess inherent in that was an understanding that, you know, there are lots of people in my position and, you know, there weren't so many things you could watch as a family. And we did kind of enjoy playing board games at that point together. And this was the closest thing to a television board game that I could think of, or at least it reminded me of that. And I thought there might be a chance that people would react to it in the same way, and fortunately, I think they did. So I think that's a very long-winded way of answering your question. I think it probably worked because it was, at that point, still something that, well, one of the few things I think that families could actually sit down and appreciate on a couple of levels, which brought them together. And that's always the challenge, I think, with any television show on mainstream commercial, on a mainstream commercial network, is to try and find something that everybody wants. And that's becoming increasingly difficult, if not impossible, because everyone's watching things that aren't television now.
And then, of course, I suppose you also have that thing as well of, will lightning strike twice when you're asked to kind of go and do it again? How much persuading did you need to kind of host it for the revival as well?
Well, not much really. I mean, I've been around long enough to know that there are no sure things and there's no real science to it. And just because some things associated with a program are measurable, that doesn't necessarily mean anything to me as a person who approaches these things creatively. And I guess when my job is simply to present someone else's work, as is the case here, it first and foremost just has to be fun for me to do, to actually generate any sort of interest at all. So a lot of the fun of those four series that we did was getting to know each other, and also me getting to know what it was to present a television show, because I had never done it, and I still don't really regard myself as a television presenter. I don't think I could no more present a television program in the way that is expected than I could fly to the moon. I just perversely can't do it. So I can play the role of somebody being a presenter, and I've often done that in comedy. And that's kind of what I'm doing. I've got a foot in the comedy camp and a foot in the presenting camp. I suppose I don't know what the hell I'm doing, quite frankly. I don't know what I'm doing or what it is or what the value of it is. It just seems to be a way for me to cope with it. I think that was the fun of the first series, was coping with the fact I had to present a pretty mainstream television show and then get to know the people on it. Now, this time around, it's a bit different because I kind of know what I'm doing now, even though it's not straight presenting, but I kind of know how to do a show. Now, I could throw to the ads without thinking about it, and I can do all those things without it being a problem, comic or otherwise. And because I know the cast, I know the captains quite well, it's a different sort of play. It's far more comfortable. If I start something with Robin, for example, she kind of knows where I'm going with it, and I kind of know what she might do with it. And ditto for Andy. Andy's been around long enough, and you know, there's a bit of discovery with Lawrence, because we don't really know each other, so we're kind of finding our way. But there's pleasure in that that's quite different from the pleasure that I got working with Charlie, who I basically kind of knew he would catch me if I was falling, or I would catch him if he was falling. You know, we can sort of do that, but we didn't really know exactly what we were going to do. Ditto Josh and ditto Amanda, and that's a different sort of more dangerous fun, I guess.
And you've sort of alluded to it already, the kind of the creative process of, you know, something of your own versus, you know, sort of wider production team. How does the process sort of differ between talking about New Generation and Mad as Hell, for instance? You know, from the outside, it sort of feels like you get the opportunity to relax in and be slightly looser in the panel format, versus it feels like every line and every thought is crafted in Mad as Hell.
Yeah. Look, they're very different shows to put together. Mad as Hell is because it is topical and it is in turnaround, and we have a blank sheet of paper on the Thursday and we record on the Tuesday. It is what it is because of the fact it's made in those few days. And yes, you're right, everything is written. I have over the years allowed myself a little bit of space to, and even during the interview, the cold interviews we do as well, there's a tiny little bit of space to at least enjoy the other person's performance. Or if I'm just doing a to-camera piece, I sometimes will react to the audience and add a couple of lines here and there, or maybe even put in a line that I'd cut out. You know, my memory is reasonably good with the material, but it's more calculated, I suppose, and it has to be, you know, because I'm speaking it probably maybe twice as fast as a normal person would if they were reading the news. You know, it's very dense, and I need to be able to communicate that in a way that's palatable and processable by the audience. So I think it's quite a fast show, and deliberately so. Whereas talking about Your Generation has a whole lot of, I mean, it has writers, but the writers really, apart from just doing the questions, create spaces within which we can find humour rather than comedy, which is a little more constructive. The fun and the humour of something is found in the game that is created. So, unlike some shows, I suppose, we don't tell the captains or the contestants any of the questions. So there's absolutely no preparation as far as they're concerned. There's preparation as far as I'm concerned, because I've got to run the thing and I have to do the tech rehearsals and everything. So I know what I'm kind of know what I'm doing, but there's a lot of space where it's just empty brackets essentially. And we trust the show to be able to find the interplay that will come up naturally. So it's kind of more marshalling a bunch of uncertainties with talking about Your Generation, whereas Mad as Hell is, you kind of know going into it exactly what you're going to do. And also, as a performer, and because I'm involved in all aspects of the production on Mad as Hell, I know I'm going to be there in the edit. So I can edit around my deficiencies. I can do that in the writing as well. I'm sort of across all part of that process, so I shepherd the whole thing through, whereas on Generation, I'm just presenting. I mean, I do come in and do a pass over the scripts, so I kind of know, you know, there might be three or four things I might pursue in a little conversation I'll have with one of the guests. But generally, it's just to give it my voice. You know, if I'm doing an opening monologue, it's like maybe 10 lines or something. That's about it. So I'll sort of put in a couple of my jokes and throw out somebody else's and maybe throw out mine and keep theirs. And then on the run, when we're performing, I make those editorial decisions in my head as we go. Sometimes the guest will come up with something in the moment that's quite funny, and there's no need then for me to do something that I'd already prepared if nothing had happened, you know. So there's that sort of chess game going on all the time. And I'm a little better at it now than I was when we first started. When we first started in the original version of the show, I tended to do everything. I just presented everything I had and then let the poor old editor have to cut it down so that it fitted in, you know, 45 commercial minutes. But now I kind of know how to do it. So I hopefully make that job a bit easier for him.
And for Mad as Hell, I presume the other thing must just be the sheer pressure, because I'm sure to consistently hit the high standard it does week in, week out, there must be plenty of times where that doesn't come as easy as it looks.
Well, this, you know, we write, I sometimes look at the pile of scripts that sits in my office at the end of the season, and it's quite a tall pile. There's a pile of no, and there's a pile of yes that went into the system, and they're about the same. So we throw away 50% of what we write before we even consider it, whether or not it can be produced. Of the material that gets the yes, probably on a week-to-week basis, probably about maybe 60% of that gets shot. And then of that 60%, half of that would go to air. And even that half would be tightened. So we'd lose lines here and there. We might lose an ending, and we might put in a, you know, we might cut it in half or whatever it is. So the Mad as Hell is 28 minutes tops, sometimes maybe blow out to 29 minutes. And we would shoot probably over an hour. And like I say, there's probably another hour's worth, maybe a little over an hour that per week that didn't get that didn't make it, you know, through the gate. So the strength, I think, of any show, not just Mad as Hell, but I think the strength of any of those sorts of shows is what you throw away. If you don't have a choice, then you kind of just got what you've got. Now, on talking about your generation, at the moment we lose a game, an episode, because the interplay is considered, you know, fun and entertaining and worthwhile. So we prefer that rather than a game. So we used to have two games in the second segment. We now only have one, but we actually recorded two. So there's a whole lot of material that actually hits the dirt, and there's a whole lot of, you know, ad-libbing and mucking around that hits the dirt. And again, I guess we'd shoot 2 hours for each hour.
And with Generation, obviously it's ended up on 9 this time rather than 10. What's, from your perspective, what's the story behind the change of networks?
Well, I guess originally I thought it might be fun just to do a reunion show on 10, you know, just to have the same cast back. That was the genesis of how it's ended up on 9, was that I thought at the end of, I think I've done Mad as Hell for maybe 7 seasons, and I thought, oh, it might be nice to, because I'd seen Charlie, or just Charlie had started the weekly, and he was around the ABC quite a bit, and, you know, sort of, I'd see him in the corridors, and you know, we still talk occasionally. We used to have lunch before he did the weekly. He'd sort of, he'd have a session with me where he'd sort of just pick my brain about it, and I could tell that's where he was going to go anyway, because he's got a natural affinity for that sort of material. You could see that on the project. So we remained in contact. Josh, occasionally I'd email and talk to him, but he was quite busy with his sitcom. But again, that was on the ABC. Amanda, I'd speak to occasionally, usually when she was in radio, but because she's in Sydney, it was sort of difficult to bump into her. And I thought it'd be fun just to do a limited series, you know, as a sort of reunion series. And everyone was keen on doing that, but unfortunately 10 couldn't accommodate it just in the schedule. I guess they had their stuff planned, and when we were all going to be all available wasn't convenient for them. So I kind of went away, I thought. And 9 then were interested, but because Amanda's tied to 10, they weren't going to be able to have Amanda. So the general view then, as I said before, was that, oh, they recast the whole thing and just do the show with a whole bunch of different people. So that's probably what would have happened with a different host had I not kind of just enjoyed myself, I suppose. It would have been a different host. They would have got someone else to do it.
So I prepared for this chat, and speaking of 10, in what might be the worst possible way, by going to YouTube and reminding myself of the time that you appeared on 10's breakfast show when Paul Henry was hosting, which I think made me a bit nervous. You'd be impossible to control as a guest, which is clearly an unfair impression. But it's also one of my favourite moments, I think, of television of the last decade.
Because if you could sit there,
your microphone is on the floor now.
Can I please be the voice of reason here?
What
and
have we done?
Can we discuss some technology with you maniacs?
Can you remember, like, ahead of time, did you know you were going to do that, or did you just go with the moment when it was kind of live? But it was just such a wonderful kind of poking fun at the artificiality of breakfast television.
Well, look, it ended up being that. I was supposed to go on there to advertise the fourth season, the final season of Talking About Your Generation, oddly enough. So I'd done the rounds, and I'd done a lot of these sorts of things. And I turned up on shows, you know, I'd done Rove's show and I'd done Adam Hill's show where I kind of misbehaved, and it was all done with approval. Like I said, look, you know, do you want to have a bit of fun with this? And they go, yeah, sure, Rove was absolutely fine with it. You know, Adam was fine with it, you know, and gently, but, you know, there was an element of playful subversion, I suppose, in that. And often that comes from my slight discomfort for having to do it, I suppose, because I have to do it. But also it's kind of expected to a certain extent. Anyway, so I didn't know anybody on this Paul Henry thing at all. But I said to the publicist, and they said, oh, we want you to do this. It's called Gen Y's. And I guess they thought that I'd be good for it because, you know, they had a Gen Y kid on there talking about social media or something, and I was supposed to take the opposing view, which is, I thought it's a pretty lame idea for a segment.
Now it's Generation Y versus Generation Y.
It's clever.
It's very clever.
Okay, but I'll go with it. Then I found out that they'd had somebody else slated in to do it the previous week and just hadn't done it, so I was a bit of a plug-in for it. And I said, look, do you mind if I have a bit of fun with it? There's not much. It's a bit of a straitjacket. Can I have a bit of fun with it? The publicist said, sure, sure. No, they love a bit of fun. And the producer of that particular show said, yes, no, they enjoy fun. They enjoy fun. Okay, great. I'll have some fun. But I think we had different definitions of what fun was, because I could tell as we were doing it, I could feel the stage, whoever the first assistant director was, I could feel the crew sort of shrink back from it.
Okay, sit down.
Absolutely.
Sit down.
Isn't this where I started?
Technology.
So I was obviously being a bit too loud or big. Paul Henry seemed okay with it, but everybody else went a bit quiet. And I thought, oh, man, there's no way I can come, but I can't really turn back now. I'm waist deep in blood. I've just got to continue with it. So I perversely just got bigger and misbehaved even more, thinking I'll just double down or triple down on it.
Are you afraid? Do you fear death?
I don't know. What do you mean? I fear death. How old do I look, Catherine? I mean, we all fear the metaphorical death of working in television.
And by the end of it, I mean, I thought it was funny, and I don't think anybody else did. When I came off, the crew were very quiet. I think the crew were amused, but they were sort of having to stifle their response to it. No one from the production came over to me at all. Nobody on the set said thank you or we'll see you later or that was okay or whatever. No one looked up from their notes, and I thought, oh man, I just completely misread this room entirely. I thought they were digging it, but they just weren't at all. So, and I never heard anything about it at all from Channel 10. No one said anything. The publicist looked ashen when I came off. So it was an example of me completely misreading what was expected of me. Anyway, the show's gone away now, so that's fine. Does it still exist on YouTube, does it? Is it still around?
It's still there in very low resolution on YouTube, I'm glad to say. Now, Sean, just finally, you've done TV, you've done radio, you've done film, you've written, you write. You get to see our media up close. What state do you actually think, and I know this is a big question, but what state do you actually think the Australian media is in? Are you optimistic?
Well, if I can, I'll step away from my own selfish needs of continued employment. I think there's so much available now to watch. I think that probably radio, in a funny sort of way, is the most, even though it's probably the oldest platform, it's the most spry in that it's able to adapt probably more to the portability that's required, that people expect of media now, in the form of podcasts or in the form of radio programs that they're cut up into what effectively are podcasts, I suppose. And the fact that everything is, you know, more or less everything, whether it's good or bad, has been digitized. And this is not only radio, but also television and film as well. Everything sits next to each other on the shelf. So one of the things we learned from in this current incarnation of Generation was that Gen Z seemed to know just as much about the baby boomer experience as the baby boomers supposedly remember as well, having experienced it. Because everything is next to each other on the shelf, it's accessible. If you want to see anything at all in the history of programming, you can probably get it without spending too much time. You can either find a low-res version of it on YouTube, or you can find a copy of it, or you can download it, or you can access it in any way you want. So that's great for the consumer. What it's done is just increased exponentially the amount of competition. So I don't know about you, but I know that I, at around about 8:30 at night, won't watch free-to-air television. I'll probably, with my wife, stream something that I missed the first time round. So, you know, and everything's available as a sort of a box set mentality. So you can, as we did, sit down and watch West Wing, which I'd never seen. And that's, how old's that? 20 years old?
Yeah, it still stands the test of time, doesn't it?
It's brilliant. It's brilliant, and it's better than anything else you find at the moment on television. And the stuff that is coming out that is good now I'll put that in the queue and get to it when I can. And the other thing that's opened up is, and this might be because Netflix, I think, and maybe, well, whatever the equivalent is of Stan overseas, let's just go with Netflix. There's these local content requirements for Netflix, so you're getting these great series that come out of Germany or in Norway or Denmark, you know, things that are specifically being made for streaming services that are just really, really interesting to look at because they've got a kind of cold Nordic sensibility, or you're getting, you know, the German show. They're called Dark. I think I just recently sat through that. It's just glorious, and there's so much of it. Now, what that does is, it's like I say, it's good for the viewer, but it makes it very, very difficult to try and make anything, particularly a narrative show, in Australia that can stack up. You know, the other thing is, of course, you turn on Netflix and you've got six series of something sitting there waiting to be watched. You know, whereas we're still, you know, you'd be lucky to get eight episodes of anything in Australia running, and then you've got, you know, you maybe wait 18 months for your funding to come through, and you might do another eight. It's going to take forever to build up the amount of quantity that is going to make it worthwhile to put on a streaming service.
I guess it'll be a while before the ex-Prime Minister will catch up with the West Wing for the number of episodes, I guess.
Yes, there's a number of rivers to cross in before it approaches being worthwhile sitting next to each other in the shelf. I think that's the challenge. That's the challenge at the moment. And as long as we have a government or an arts minister who gets behind the idea of having representation of our stories and understands that it does actually cost money for the production values to compete and make these things worthwhile. And it's not just production values, it's also writing, and it's also having the luxury to be able to have a bit of time to make these shows. I mean, often in my own personal experience with trying to make anything approaching a narrative drama is that you've got to make, if you're doing eight episodes, you've got to make it in 7 weeks. you know, whereas if you were anywhere else in the world, you would probably have, at the very least, 8 weeks to make eight episodes, probably 16 weeks to make eight episodes. And like I say, it's always the case. The quality comes because you've thrown away stuff that hasn't worked. Not everything works. That's why good television or good radio is worth listening to, because you're capturing some moments that, you know, is worthwhile. But if you don't allow yourself the opportunity to make a mistake or to go down a road that doesn't pay off, you won't take any risks. And if you don't take any risks because you've got the money, then you end up being very bland. And I'm afraid that's just not going to cut it. Competitively, people will look at that and they see how safe it is. They can feel how safe it is as a viewer. They go, that car's too shiny, or that performance is too pat, or those people are just sitting at the kitchen table talking for 10 minutes when, you know, you could have 7 more setups if you had a bit more money. You know what I mean? To make it look more cinematic. Television can't afford to look like television anymore. It's just dull.
Sean, speaking of time, I'm very grateful for the amount of time that you've found for us during what must be a very busy week. So thank you very much for your generosity in talking.
Thank you for joining us on the Mumbrella Cast this week. If everything goes to plan, we'll be coming to you from Mumbrella 360 next episode. So tune in to see if we succeed at remote roaming podcasting in the midst of 6 streams of content, almost 2,500 attendees and 130 speakers. In the meantime, for the benefit of future listeners, I'd like it on the record that I, for one, welcome our new robot overlords, and I'll speak to you next time.